I'm telling these tears go and fall away, fall away.
Oh. What's up, Wisconsin? I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network, broadcasting statewide from Civic Media's Waukesha studios, the WAUK. Happy early Memorial Day weekend, everybody. Hope you've got some relaxing time planned over, hopefully a full 3 days off for you. I know what I need is an escape from Justice Alito's terrible violations of any sort of semblance of judicial ethics. Also, I want to see a couple Brewers wins. That's probably top of the list. Maybe at equal standing with fewer ethical violations by one of our Supreme Court justices. Don't worry, of course, Civic Media's got you covered if you want to listen to the Brewers game. They're playing the Boston Red Sox first pitch at 6:10 p.m. this evening. We've got you on news from the center, WRCE, Racine and Kenosha on WRJN, in Oshkosh on WISS, and of course, WCQM in Park Falls. So do check out the Brewers on your Civic Media radio network. We've got a stacked show today. And without further ado, I'm going to bring on my first guest for the day, attorney Daniel Cotter, expert on the Supreme Court, especially the Chief Justice, which seems to be, I think, Daniel, he's a partner at Dickinson and Wright out of Chicago. Daniel, welcome. I think the question that I have is, where the heck is the Chief Justice? What should he be doing right now to get Samuel Alito in line? Because this is ridiculous.
Well, thanks for having me, and pleased to be on the show today, and thank you. You know, I have written about, I think, in the past, the leadership and moral kind of compass of the court comes from the center seat, the Chief Justice. And when I ranked in my book the Chief Justices, three came to mind that were really distinctive for their ability to, by their leadership, by their kind of moral compass, able to lead a court through difficult times. The first is Chief Justice John Marshall, fourth mm-hmm. Chief Justice of the United States, and my law school changed its name. There's been a lot of controversy about him in the last several years about his slave trading and his treatment of Native Americans. But when you read about him and his chief justiceship, for all but the first few years of his tenure, he had mostly anti-federalists on. He was a federalist, a strong nationalist, and yet all the decisions were mostly unanimous by force of his power of persuasion and power of prestige of the court. He was able to convince people. One of the justices that came on wrote a dissent early in his career and said he never wrote another one because he was so humiliated and corrected by Marshall. Charles Evans Hughes.
If I can, just for a minute, let's explain to people. I clerked for a federal appeals court judge, Judge Michael Caney on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Let's just take a pause because I don't think most people are familiar with sort of forgetting where we are today, but in the before times when things were normal, many chief justices, as well as federal appeals courts, when they sit as panels, and now an appeals court usually hears an appeal that's coming from a federal trial court and a panel of three. Sometimes they'll hear, the entire court will hear a case that's called en banc. And the Supreme Court, of course, there's nine of them. Back in the olden times, it was generally the case that justices would effectively argue amongst themselves, if we're talking about the Supreme Court, or appeals court judges would argue amongst themselves to try to persuade their colleagues so that they would reach as many unanimous decisions as possible, because the justices understood that in doing so, it helps maintain at the time, or in today's language, restore the public's trust and faith in the court, that despite the fact that judges and justices may be appointed over many decades by presidents of different parties, if the justices or judges, in the case of an appeals court, speak as one and speak with unanimity, folks can look to the court and say, yeah, this isn't politics. This isn't the tail wagging the dog. These are judges and justices that argue amongst themselves. And what you're pointing to, Daniel, so that people have a foothold here, is that when you look at the Supreme Court, it is the Chief Justice's job to try to manage his or her colleagues, it's always been a man, so I'll say his colleagues on the Supreme Court, into a place of greatest potential alignment, that, that the Chief Judge Justice is supposed to try to wrangle his colleagues into as much alignment as he can muster to, again, be giving the public the greatest opportunity to have faith in the court. And what you're pointing to is that Justice Marshall, in a topic that maybe I'll have you back on another show to discuss, despite much of the recent criticism, what he was expert at was bringing about that unanimity. Am I explaining that right? So people kind of get where we're coming from as people that that deal with some of the nerdy legal stuff that's going on here.
You're absolutely right. And you know, the justice who probably, again, exemplifies that. And when there was some perception of influence or bad behaviors on the court, Abe Fortas, the name comes up. It was last week, I think, in 1968, that he was forced to resign. And what happened there was he had taken some money in an honorarium at a school. He also was given some money by one of his former partners or clients and returned the money. There was an ethical investigation of Abe Fortas. He was not forced to resign. He wasn't impeached or anything. But what happened in that case, Maggie, and is instructive here of maybe an absence of kind of the same type of leadership or interest, is that Chief Justice Earl Warren got together with the other justices, and they said that this is a mark on the court, and the legacy and prestige and independence of this court has to be the main focus. And so they spoke with Abe Fortas, and he resigned and went on to practice and do other things. But there's an instance, and there's a lot of, if you read John Dean's book and other things, that was another.
And remind people who John Dean is.
John Dean was the Watergate, was counsel to President Nixon. And he was the one that eventually discovered that everything was being taped because he would have conversations, and then he realized that Haldeman and Nixon and others in the cabinet were having these meetings. He got in trouble for some of the Watergate issues. And he's written several books, and he talks about the court. But you know, what happened was Earl Warren in 1968 wanted to retire, and LBJ was still president. He gave his resignation. And then Nixon, who was campaigning, did some underground work and found this information about Fortas. And so Warren stayed on, and then the rest is history.
I actually mentioned the case of Justice Abe Fortas when I discussed Justice Alito on Wednesday. And just again, so great minds. I always love that, Daniel, when we're talking about the same stuff. Just to remind folks, Abe Fortas, it was a $20,000 consulting fee that ended up, which he paid back. Again, he gave that back. Can you imagine Justice Thomas returning the RV? I don't know how you return a $1,000 a day fishing trip either. But again, he gave the money back, and he still stepped down. And to this point about the strength of the Chief Justice and the power of the other justices to try to bring to bear if they're going to truly self-police, because there's no binding code of ethics that applies to the Supreme Court. The critical nature of that peer-to-peer pressure, that is what happened in the case of former Justice Fortas. It was his fellow justices, as well as Chief Justice Warren, that pressured him to step down. Again, the New York Times writing at the time, a judge not only has to be innocent of any wrongdoing, but he also has to be above reproach, as then so too now, except if your name is Clarence Thomas or Justice Alito. It's truly odd times. And in case anybody's living, again, under a massive boulder and didn't see any of the news for the last 2 days, the day after I got done talking about how completely compromised Justice Alito was, this was on Wednesday, yesterday or late Wednesday, I should say, rather, the New York Times put out a story that another flag was flown by Justice Alito. This time it was last summer for around 2 months at his vacation home, his summer home. Isn't it nice to have multiple homes? That was the, quote, appeal to heaven flag, also known as the pine tree flag, which has, just like the upside down American flag, become a symbol of the Stop the Steal MAGA movement. And again, the shocking thing here is when that flag was and there's numerous photographs, apparently at least four photographs, each taken by different people. It even shows up on a Google Street View image. You can't make this stuff up. And the thing that's really, both of them are absolutely reprehensible and a violation of the mandate that the court and each justice must be above reproach. It's that when this flag was flying, the court knew and Justice Alito knew that an appeal was going to be before them with respect to whether or not the obstruction charges can and should stand against the January 6th rioters, as well as the former MAGA president. I mean, Dan, where do you put this, given all of your research and expertise, in terms of bad faith by justices of the court? My guest this half hour and for the rest of this hour is Supreme Court expert, attorney extraordinaire, Daniel Cotter. He's even written the book on it called The Chief Justices. We're going to take a couple of messages, come back with attorney Cotter, and I want him to rate this on the scale of bad faith by Supreme Court justices. Rate this on the scale of all ethical lapses by Supreme Court justices. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Stay put. We'll be back in just a moment. May the last one burn into flames.
Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
Judicial system.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We're coming to you live from the WAUK, but we got you covered statewide. You want to find your local station, you can go ahead and download for free the Civic Media app, or just hop on our website at civicmedia.us. My guest this hour, attorney and Supreme Court expert, especially on the Chief Justices and their role on the court, is attorney Daniel Cotter, a member of the Chicago-based law firm Dickinson and Wright. Thanks for being here, Daniel. Right before the break, we were talking about Justice Alito, the two-time flag controversy now, both the upside-down American flag, known symbol for the Stop the Steal movement, being flown just days after the January 6th insurrection. And then last summer, for approximately 2 months, flying the pine flag, another Stop the Steal symbol. Federal recusal law is clear, quote, any justice, judge, or magistrate of the United States shall disqualify himself in any proceeding in which his impartiality might reasonably question. We know the Supreme Court earlier this year adopted an ethics code that basically said you're to avoid any even appearance of bias. We know also that Justice Thomas did in fact recuse himself from at least one case that is involving his former law clerk. That's probably the easiest recusal case to ever come before a Supreme Court justice. His former law clerk, of course, the now disgraced, nearly disbarred John Eastman. So we have all of this as context and lead up. How bad is this from a history of the court perspective? And specifically, we'll get to Justice Thomas. But how bad are these actions by Justice Alito? Folks, if you would like to text in a comment or question for Daniel or join our conversation. Don't forget 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. How bad is this, Daniel?
To me, the stench is very bad. It is bad. It's interesting, though, because on LinkedIn and other places, I posted about the flag, and people, first of all, attack always credible media, the New York Times. It's been around for a long time. And does it make mistakes? Sure. Is it biased for Democrats? That's questionable. I think there's been a lot of studies of that in recent years, especially with the Hillary emails and then all kinds. You go on and on and on, you know. But, you know.
Well, it's. I mean, if I can jump in here, Daniel. Okay, criticize the source, but is the fact the fact? And then deal with the fact. I mean, stop arguing about who's the messenger. Is the thing that they're talking about an actual problem? How do you rate the actual problem here, these two flags being flown by Justice Alito?
I think it's wrong. And again, I think ethical code or not, I think if you were supposed to be, as he would have you believe, as textualists and originalists would have you believe, that he's just interpreting the law, he's interpreting the Constitution, this is someone that to me, it's just inappropriate. I was saying to somebody recently, you know, during the Korematsu or the those types of cases, if somebody had you know, anti-Japanese sentiments or other things, when you have cases before you and you're flying the flag of that cause and rally, including the cases that are before it right now on President Trump's immunity, on the January 6th, and what otherwise means in the terms of insurrection and obstruction. This rates as high as anything I can think of. And again, I think, you know, a lot of people have both sided it. And, you know, we talk about like Sotomayor when she had her book out and like what she did. RBG made comments about Trump back in 2016 and then apologized. She donated to the National Organization of Women. But to me, this goes above and beyond it. And the flag flying he's shown his true colors. And, he was appointed before he got to the Supreme Court for the Third Circuit. And I've been thinking lately, a title of an article I may write is The Third Robed Reich, because... He's, you know, Trump's talked about this unified Reich and you know, it really, to me, again, it stinks of just bad, not just optics, but actual what he believes. And this is a guy who, you know, has alleged that, like OJ, he's looking for the violators and leakers of his Dobbs decision, which many think
it was him.
It was him. You know, But again, and then he went on a gloat tour. He makes statements. Again, this is a guy, remember, he last appeared at the State of the Union and said that's false or whatever. This is a guy who is very political. And
just to refresh everyone's recollection about that, Justice Alito was seated at the State of the Union while President Barack Obama was speaking, and actually said out loud, basically contradicted a president in the House of Representatives chamber as the president was speaking. Now, this is below any standard of behavior for any judge anywhere, least of which a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. The guy doesn't think any of the rules apply to him, and he behaves with the certitude that only the most arrogant folks who really know that they have no accountability would behave with. I think that's, to me, one of the things that's so disturbing is what not just the bias that his behavior and his actions over now decades have demonstrated, but the complete and total confidence that he can do these things, violate all norms, violate any reasonable sense of ethical standards, and never be held accountable.
And you know, the sad thing is that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who he replaced, she really regretted taking early retirement to help with her husband, because what happened was Chief Justice Rehnquist passed away shortly after when Roberts was nominated for an associate justice position, and President Bush pulled that nomination and made him the Chief Justice, which you know, Alito was not happy with. He thought he should have been the Chief Justice. And then,
of course he did.
Yeah, but she knew what the court was getting, because his Third Circuit work,
yes,
which is a major court of appeals, he was very clear in his views, and he's lived up to it. But again, you know, if you to me, there's nothing quite like this. It's not, there's nothing quite like this situation.
Yes,
in the, of the court.
Sorry to jump in here, Danny. We got to take a couple of very important messages, including the farm update for folks. We're going to be back after these important messages with my special guest this hour, Daniel Cotter, expert on the Supreme Court, has written the book, The Chief Justices, partner at Dickinson and Wright. Don't go anywhere. We're going to continue to dig in on Alito and Justice Thomas after these messages. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
Freedom.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Happy Friday. Happy early Memorial Day weekend. We're broadcasting to you live from downtown Waukesha, WAUK. My guest this hour is Supreme Court expert. He's written the book on the Chief Justices. It is called The Chief Justices. You can find it on Amazon, of course. His name is Daniel Cotter, who's a partner at Dickinson and Wright in Chicago. We were talking about before, and I'd like to return to the role of the Chief Justice in trying to maintain some semblance of control over the Supreme Court and over the justices themselves. Arguably, the Supreme Court has got two of the most critical decisions currently pending before it that we've seen in quite some time. There's lots of them. Of course, Dobbs counts, Students for Fair Admissions. All major cases have come before the court. But of course, the question of presidential immunity, as well as whether or not the obstruction of Congress charge will be maintained against not just the former MAGA president, but the balance of the January 6th criminal defendants. What is Justice Roberts' role? What do you think, Daniel, in your estimation, should he be doing in the face of not just Samuel Alito's evident, obvious, ongoing bias, but also the fact that Clarence Thomas is clearly not going to recuse himself from either of these matters, despite the fact that his wife was actively texting and encouraging the then MAGA president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, to, in effect, accept the arguments that the vice president could stop the counting of the Electoral College votes. What is the Chief Justice's role right now?
So the Chief Justice's role, and he talked about it in his nomination confirmation hearings, and I read about it a lot in the book. The Chief Justice, just as a step back, is one of nine justices now. That's, the numbers varied, but one of nine justices. It's like Animal Farm, as I write in the book at the beginning. All nine justices are equal, but some are more equal than others. the Chief Justice is the chief administrative officer of the courts. He sets the tone in conference. So what happens is they hear the oral arguments, and then Thursday or Friday at the end of each week, they only hear arguments Monday through Wednesday usually. Thursday or Friday they meet in conference. It's nobody's there. There's no notes taken or minutes. And he starts off by talking about his views on the case, and then it goes in terms of seniority. And again, historically, when you see John Marshall, when you see Earl Warren, who we talked about with Abe Fortas, the thing I write about the book and one of the most powerful stories of Earl Warren is Brown versus Board of Education had been argued the spring before he became Chief Justice. Chief Justice Vincent had a heart attack, and Earl Warren cashed in on his promise from President Eisenhower through Nixon that he would become the next justice when a vacancy occurred. He gets to D.C. They rehear Brown versus Board within 30 days. He's not even confirmed yet by the Senate. And then over the next several months, every day he tells the justices, we're not voting on it in conference. And then he starts to put it on them. He says, if we come out anything than a unanimous opinion overturning Brown versus Board, think of the legacy and think what we're saying, that blacks are truly inferior. And the evidence is Felix Frankfurter and others that were on the court the term before, if it had been decided, if Vincent had died, would have come down 5-4 in favor of upholding Plessy versus Ferguson. So long way of saying the Chief Justice and the powerful ones in our history have through their influence, through their moral leadership, through their intellectual leadership, have been able to guide the court through these tough times. And I write about a lot at the end of the book because at the time when Roberts appeared before the confirmation and Senate judiciary hearings, he talked about two focuses. One was his adherence to law, but the second was this legacy, this broader concept that we're talking about now, right? And the image and just the appearances of the court. It was very strong that he was going to have a court that was going to be cordial, was going to be as many majority 9-0 opinions as possible, but more importantly, that he was going to kind of run the show and on the ethics issues, on the leakage issues, on other issues that have come before the court in recent times. He's admonished others who have called into question his colleagues, and he hasn't, in my view, he has not been that strong leader that says we've got to make sure that this stuff looks and smells right to the public. And you know, your listeners may be aware, but last June or July, at the end of the term, this current Supreme Court has the lowest credibility and prestige in the history of these pollings, at like 19%. It's as low as the House and Senate. And so, you know.
Why isn't that? I mean, when I step back and I look at it, I think, again, the historical context of what Earl Warren did in probably the single most famous Supreme Court case, perhaps other than Roe v. Wade, that most Americans have at least heard of, to bring about unanimity, but not just unanimity for unanimity's sake, unanimity within this very clear sense that Earl Warren had, Chief Justice Warren had, that this will be part of history. One of the things that just boggles my mind is the flagrance with which these justices are operating, again, flouting any common sense, just man or woman on the streets idea of if we took it out of the particular politics and just asked a regular person, does this seem right to you? I think people would universally say no. But within this sense of history, these folks seem to be convinced that they're getting it right. And it just, that's what seems so crazy to me, that, oh yes, a president is immune from certain things, of course so. And we can go ahead and engage in this sort of activity that clearly demonstrates bias. And I'm sure history will treat us kindly. What do you think's operating there? Is it just Chief Justice Roberts' weakness as a leader? Is it hubris? Is it, again, the sort of arrogant thought that of course we're right? It just seems to me that they lack any sense of how history will view this time.
It's all of the above. And you mentioned Roe v. Wade, and again, it's no longer the law. Dobbs overturned it. But what I think a lot of people don't realize with Roe v. Wade is number one, it was Chief Justice Warren Burger. It wasn't Earl Warren, so it wasn't part of his liberal court. But number two, it was a 7-2 opinion, and of the seven people in the majority, five were Republican appointed.
Correct.
And the only dissenters were Rehnquist, who was a Nixon appointee, and Brennan, based on this Catholic church. You know, it's and it, the case wasn't even looked at for many years after. You know, I sometimes ponder that, and I think part of it is almost when it comes to Justice Thomas, and I think a little bit of Justice Alito, I think it's almost the Fugazi flip that Scalia did years ago, right? The chin flick. He said it means one thing, but and the get over it aspect of Bush v. Gore, right? You know, just get over it, because this is how we do it. I do think there is some certainty. I think they think that they have the moral upper hand. And my challenge is always this: is that Chief Justice John Marshall was an originalist, and he did certain things back in his time, and had certain views and opinions. Why is he not a better originalist? He was actually at the Constitutional Ratifying Convention in Virginia, or Hugo Black, who was an originalist, you know, back in the 30s. Why is somebody that's 200 and something years removed from the founding? But I think there's some moral certitude, but I also think, again, I think it's just a matter. I mean, it's, to me, it's shocking when these news reports come out, and again, they attack the messenger, but the reality is ProPublica, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, whoever's coming out with these things, the reality is that this is what's happening. And again, it's out transparent, and they, at least some justices, don't seem to have any concerns about what they're doing. They flout their opinions. They shut down dissent and think that they're doing the right thing. And
well, Alito's argument in his Wall Street Journal op-ed that, of course, Congress can't legislate the court is sort of, again, boggles my mind in both its incorrectness and arrogance. We've been talking about a couple of cases. You mentioned Bush v. Gore. Of course, the justices were careful in that case to denote it as sui generis, meaning of only applying only to these facts. They were explicitly stating this shall not establish a precedent. These justices inclined to grant presidential immunity explicitly said during oral arguments, no, we're going to make history here. This is a decision that will stand for time. They had this very, explicit and direct idea that they're going to make law forever now. I wanted to just make note of a couple of very interesting things that have happened just in the past week on a couple of cases. And I know Brian has got some of these justices from their confirmation hearings talking about their respect for stare decisis.
Ready to go.
let's listen to a couple of them. Hit me with a little Alito saying stare decisis is so very important.
If the issue were to come before me, if I am fortunate enough to be confirmed and the issue were to come before me, the first question would be the question that we've been discussing, and that's the issue of stare decisis.
Yeah, and again, he just threw that out the window, right? It, when you look at presidential immunity, the presumption in U.S. v. Nixon and all along the way is that there is no such thing in absolute terms. Of course, Dobbs tossed out the precedent of Roe v. Wade. In other words, Samuel Alito is a liar, repeatedly a liar. He's been lying about the flag, blames his wife. Oh, it's not political. Well, political speech. Well, then why would you put up the flag like that in response to a neighbor's duck Trump sign? It doesn't make any sense. I also want to call out this. If folks don't like to spend their free time reading Supreme Court cases, Daniel and I have you covered, because there was a great tidbit in the Alexander versus South Carolina case that was just issued this week. Now, the decision truly disturbing in its basically indifference towards gerrymandering with the express purpose of suppressing the votes of Black and brown folks, just trussing it up with the fig leaf of its political gerrymandering.
And more stare decisis.
Right? Exactly.
One person, one vote.
Yeah, except when not, right? Of course. Justice Kagan, in her dissent, wrote this line, because she is a witty one. The woman has a very sharp pen. She wrote this: But as with its upside down application of clear error review, the majority is intent on changing the usual rules when it comes to addressing racial gerrymandering claims. The majority in that case being written by Samuel Alito. The upside down reference, certainly not lost on me or you, Daniel, I'm sure. No. It's a reference. She's calling out the flag issue.
It's a great line.
Yeah, props to Justice Elena Kagan. I also wanted to ask you very briefly about, frankly, Alito got trolled by his buddy, Justice Thomas, in the CFPB case, which is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Again, textualism is only a thing when they want it to be. And Samuel Alito turned himself in knots to come to an absurd result, got made fun of basically in nice terms by Justice Thomas. I'm going to be back after these brief messages with my special guest this hour, Supreme Court expert, expert on the Chief Justices. He wrote the book on him, literally, the Chief Justices. Lawyer from Dickinson and right out of Chicago, Daniel Cotter. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after these important messages here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
It is a precedent of the United States Supreme Court. It was reaffirmed in Casey in 1992 and in several other cases. So a good judge will consider it as precedent of the United States Supreme Court, worthy as treatment of precedent like any other.
Stayed in bed all morning just to pass the time. There's something wrong here.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from the WAUK in beautiful downtown Waukesha. Happy early Memorial Day weekend, everyone. Thought I'd send us off with a bang. Brought on my friend and Supreme Court expert, attorney Daniel Cotter. He probably has, at least we think, it's believed that he has the largest collection of biographies and books on the Supreme Court in one place. He even sent me a picture. I believe the guy, and I'm a book nerd. I got a lot of them myself, but that is an impressive collection, Daniel. I wanted to ask you about a particular case that is, I think, cited as at least one of the two also direct conflicts of interest, and that's the Moore v. United States case that Samuel Alito has heard. At the time the case is pending before the court, it's a tax case. We don't even need to get into the substance of the matter because it's very, very nerdy. He was granted a series of interviews by the Wall Street Journal, and one of the interviewers was an attorney that was appearing before him in the Moore case. Is that normal?
Well, in this current environment, it sure seems to be there. When some of these abortion cases and other cases on various issues, religious freedom have been argued, there's pictures of him, in the conference rooms of the courthouse, pictures and hobnobbing with them. There's all these pictures of these jaunts. People should be reminded that Justice Scalia passed away on a boondoggle down in Texas at the Hibernian Ancient Society on a hunting trip that was fully free and paid for. And again, when we go back to Fortas, I mean, he's got to be rolling over in his grave the $20,000. One of the things that's been written about as well is that all the justices these days get to write books. They're usually not that entertaining or great, but they all have books. and because there's so many First Amendment cases, Random House and the major publishing books appear before them all the time. Should that be the case? No, you probably shouldn't be. The interview thing, I mean, it's a bit troubling, but I don't have major heartburn on that. But there's so many other incidents, and
of course, you reference his luxurious fishing trip, financed largely by a billionaire by the name of Paul Singer. And Justice Alito, over the course of the subsequent 10 years following that fishing trip, 10 plus years, heard numerous cases or decided whether or not to take up cases, eventually did take up a case that ended up netting Mr. Singer, his benefactor on this luxurious fishing trip, north of $2.4 billion. Abe Fortas, over his 20 grand consulting fee that he gave back, is rolling over in his grave. It's stunning. I just want to share with you some of the comments from the text line. Brian K, listening on Madison's 92.7 WMDX, texting in, reminding us that three of the four Nixon appointed judges voted to find a privacy right in Roe v. Wade. Brennan voted for Roe. The other dissenter was Byron White, a Kennedy, a JFK appointed judge.
That's right.
Thanks so much for listening, Brian. Keep texting and listening. You want to get in your two cents before the top of the hour, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. My special guest, Daniel Cotter, expert on the Supreme Court. We certainly have to lighten it up a wee bit. Before we do so, I just want to, again, remind folks that one of the incredible elements of just arrogance and audacity is that the Supreme Court has rules for its staff. And those rules include the following: employees may not engage in partisan political activity. Partisan political activity is political activity relating to elections contested by political parties. For example, employees may not publicly support or oppose a partisan political organization or candidate. This includes displaying signs or bumper stickers or stating positions on social media. Also, employees may not engage in nonpartisan political activity if the activity could reflect adversely on the dignity or impartiality of the court, or if it interferes with official duties. Well, that's good for the staff, but apparently Alito can fly a flag outside of his home saying, "I'm with Trump and I'm with the Stop the Steal movement." Staff have rules, but not him, I guess.
They're the NASCAR 9, right? They can put their bumper stickers and decals of who I mean, that's where we're getting to. It might as well be, right? And the court, like you said, the court's got these two important decisions. It's also got, it has two abortion cases on the agenda. It has the Chevron doctrine, the future of the administrative state. It has a lot of
I have talked about that sucker repeatedly on the show, because folks don't realize that one will probably impact people's day-to-day lives more than anything else. Chevron doctrine is that the judiciary will defer to the expert research and analysis that executive branch departments make. Of course, the conservatives have carved out an exception, which they call the major doctrine exception, which basically says, yes, we'll defer to experts, except when it's a really big deal, in which case we judges with no expertise in the given subject matter area, we'll just make it up. Stay tuned on that one. They're about to do away with Chevron entirely. I just want to go out on a light note, Daniel. We're wrapping up here. There was a pretty funny truck that was rolling around outside of the Phillies game, because Alito is a huge Phillies fan. And on this truck outside the Phillies game, it said the following. It had basically a baseball card that looks like Samuel Alito. And it says this: trade Alito to the Braves. He flies the American flag upside down, takes away your freedoms, and gives the Phillies bad luck. Trade Alito to the Braves. We got to leave it there. Thanks so much, Daniel. I really appreciate you being here. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.
You too.
Up next on the Maggie Dawn Show, I'm going to be joined by James Causey. We're going to be breaking it down. Why are there all of these affairs with teachers and students? Reporter extraordinaire from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, James Causey, up next. You're not going to want to miss it. Your news, weather, and sports are up next. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network.
It's too late now, darling. It's too late. There's a lot of, badness